It is Friday, April the 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, the latest on the so-called Chibok girls, also ahead containing the Islamic State.
It's harder than ever for them to move and for them to mass forces. When they try, we take them out.
World Bank chief on the Panama Papers, wealthy country failing disadvantaged children, plus Erykah Badu's Twitter war. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. 2 years ago, Boko Haram insurgents kidnapped hundreds of schoolgirls from the Nigerian town of Chibok, and now a video has emerged purporting to show 15 of them alive and well. It's the first sighting of the missing students in nearly 2 years. VOA's Chris Stein is in Lagos, Nigeria, with our report.
The camera pans shakily over the girls' faces as they recite their names and where they were abducted from. The video, which was obtained by CNN, is the first time any of the 219 abducted girls have been seen publicly since Boko Haram released a propaganda video featuring a group of them shortly after their capture in 2014. The kidnappings from the government secondary school in Chibok drew global protests. Allies, including the United States, offered to help Nigeria find them. So far, they've turned up nothing. Yana Galang is the mother of one of the abducted girls who has seen the video.
Yes, they are all girls.
Her daughter, Rifkatu Dalam, was not among the girls in the video, Galang said. She declined to comment further. Minister of Information and Culture Lai Mohammed said he questions the authenticity of the video. In the video, one girl claims to be speaking on December 25th of last year. Mohammed said he found that hard to believe, since many of the girls hadn't changed in appearance during their months in captivity. He also said the government has received numerous false leads about the girls' whereabouts, including a similar video they obtained last July. The video isn't the only evidence that the girls are still alive. Yakubu Nkeke, chairman of the abducted Chibok girls' parents' movement for rescue, says parents of two of the girls have recently received phone calls from their daughters' cell phone numbers. But when they called back, the voice on the other end was an unidentified man, who told the parents the phone belonged to his wife. As residents of the town gathered at the ruins of the school to mark the two-year anniversary, Chibok elder Ayuba Alamson said many had taken heart in the girls' appearance in the video.
People have been offering prayers right yesterday and today to see that we see these girls alive.
Others were wary. Philip Yama, whose sister Margaret Yama was abducted, says he's heard too many rumors about the girls since the abduction to take the video at face value.
I can't believe it until I saw these girls with my own eyes.
In the 2 years since the abduction, Chibok has changed, in many ways for the worse. The government has demolished the town's school, and despite promises to replace it, has not built a new one. 18 parents of kidnapped girls have since passed away, NKK said. They lost their lives to Boko Haram, or ailments related to the stress of waiting for the return of their missing daughters. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
Also in the news, a Muslim American congressman is calling for the Islamic State militants. He's calling them a collection of liars, murderers, torturers, and rapists after the group threatened to kill him. Representative Keith Ellison, a Minnesota Democrat, lashed out at the terrorists, saying no Muslim he knows recognizes what the Islamic State preaches as Islam. Islamic State issued death threats this week against a number of people it calls politically active apostates in the United States, Australia, Britain, and Canada. President Obama held a meeting with his national security team this week and then spoke with reporters, insisting the Islamic State is on the defensive in Iraq and Syria.
Our air campaign, more than 11,500 strikes so far, continues to pound ISIL targets. It's harder than ever for them to move and for them to mass forces. When they try, we take them out. ISIL still has managed to advance in some areas of Syria and Iraq, but it has not had a single successful major offensive operation on the ground there since last summer. So it's been nearly a year since they were able to mount a major successful offensive operation. We continue to take out their leaders, their commanders, and those plotting terrorist attacks. For ISIL's leadership, it has been a bad few months. Coalition forces captured Abu Dawood, a leader of its chemical weapons program, giving us critical information that's allowed us to unleash more strikes against those sites. We have removed Abu Sarah, ISIL financier in Iraq, Haji Iman, their finance chief, Izzat al-Jabouri, an ISIL figure in northern Iraq, not to mention a number of top foreign terrorist fighters.
President Obama said the Islamic State presence in Syria and Iraq continues to shrink, and the ranks of its fighters is estimated to be at the lowest level it has been in 2 years. He said many realize their cause is lost. Terrorism analyst Greg Barton of Deakin University in Australia tells VOA's Victor Beatty via Skype that Mr. Obama is right about the fate of the militants in the long run, but says the battle will have to be waged for a long time.
If you think about the origins of this, Islamic State is third generation Al-Qaeda, so we've got three decades coming out of Afghanistan of the 1980s. We've got the rise of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which began in 2003 with the invasion and occupation. So this has been a long time in the making. It's not going to go away quickly this year or next. The specific question of when can Mosul be retaken from Islamic State, when can Raqqa be retaken, it certainly won't be this year. Whether we begin to see real breakthroughs next year will depend very much on the Syrian peace process, because it would certainly be much easier to move on Raqqa and the other cities on the Euphrates with the civil war resolved. But even in the best case scenario, I think this is going to be several years. And then even then, we won't see the end of Islamic State. It may well be that it's got a foothold in Lebanon that we can't shake loose from, or in the Sinai or beyond, or that it falls back simply to a sort of a global insurgency. But I think we'd be naive to suggest that within the next year or two we'll have this problem solved.
Mr. Obama did acknowledge an uptick of the Islamic State presence in Libya. Have you noticed an uptick?
We're seeing many Libyans, young Libyans, had gone to fight in Syria and Iraq, and many of them now come back to Libya, it seems, under express orders to set up an IS presence there. And we are seeing a considerable area of the coastlines in central Libya pretty much under the control of IS. Non-Libyans have been coming in. So, you know, the best accounts is perhaps 6,000 people fighting for them there. That's a very significant presence. Now, everyone hopes that the coalition unity government will work and the pressure will be brought upon the Islamic State presence. But that also may be unresolved for some years.
A Pentagon spokesman on Wednesday in Baghdad said the U.S.-led coalition campaign against Islamic State successfully entered a second phase of operations. He said the first phase was to weaken the enemy. Now he says they're going to work to fracture him and finally to dismantle in the third phase.
The trend is good. But the thing about long wars, and we saw this with the great wars of the 20th century, is that things ebb and flow. That will be the case here as well. At the moment, it seems like the momentum is with the international coalition and with the Iraqi security forces. They're doing the right things. They're moving forward. If that trend continues, we can see them taking back more towns along both the Euphrates and the Tigris and eventually retaking Mosul.
That is terrorism analyst Greg Barton of Deakin University in Australia. He was speaking via Skype with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa.
VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is VOA's International Edition. A United Nations Children's Fund study has found a widening gap between poor and richer children in the world's wealthiest countries. And as Lisa Schlein reports now from Geneva, the UNICEF report ranking the well-being of children in 41 high-income countries analyzes the consequences of this growing inequality.
The gap between rich and poor in most wealthy countries is at its highest level in three decades. The new UNICEF study uses four indicators, income, education, health, and life satisfaction, to measure the growing inequality between children at the bottom and those in the middle in high-income countries. UNICEF social policy economic specialist Yekaterina Chen says the 41-country rankings are based on how far children at the bottom of the distribution fall below their peers in the middle.
Countries like Denmark, Finland, Norway, Austria, and Switzerland do best overall, while countries like the United Kingdom and the United States are right in the middle. At the same time, at the bottom of the overall ranking, we have countries like Turkey, Israel, Bulgaria, and Italy.
The report shows income inequality has increased substantially in one-third of the countries studied between 2008 and 2013. It finds inequality gaps in educational achievement have narrowed. At the same time, inequality in children's health has increased in almost all countries. It notes some improvements also have been made in physical activity and healthier eating among poor children in a majority of the countries. Chen tells VOA, some of the richest countries are letting their most disadvantaged children fall far behind all others. But she says the report presents a mixed picture in that some nations that do badly overall do quite well on other indicators.
So a country like the US, that is known for its high levels of income inequality overall, quite unsurprisingly, does quite badly on a measure of bottom-end inequality among children. But at the same time, it ranks quite highly on a measure of inequality in education.
Chen says poor children do better in countries that have well-established welfare systems and redistribution of income between the richest and poorest. The Nordic countries tend to fall into this category. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
World Bank President Jim Yong Kim says he is extremely concerned about the widespread creation of offshore companies by wealthy people around the world to evade taxes, saying it takes large sums away from governments who need the money to fight poverty. Kim told a news conference in Washington he was distressed by the scope of the offshore accounts as disclosed in the Panama Papers. That's a massive leak of documents from a Panamanian law firm that for decades has helped create the companies across the globe.
We're extremely concerned about the fact that it's been revealed once again, and it's not, it was no mystery. We knew that these things were happening, but I want to stress that when taxes are evaded, that when state assets are taken and put into these havens, all of these things can have a tremendously negative effect on our mission to end poverty and boost shared prosperity.
Kim said he's worried about the recession in Russia, for instance, whose economy has been hobbled by declining oil revenues and Western sanctions aimed at Moscow for its 2014 takeover of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula.
We're very concerned about Russia. We expect Russia will have negative growth again this year. And of course, when Russia has negative growth, it has an impact on many of the countries in the region. And it is one of the major drags on growth in the developing world.
Meanwhile, International Monetary Fund Managing Director Christine Lagarde says the global economy is on alert but not alarm right now. Speaking at the IMF spring meeting in Washington, Lagarde said there are signs sentiment is improving around the world, but recovery remains slow and fragile in many parts of the world.
We expect global growth this year to be at 3.2% and 3.5% next year. This makes it harder to spread economic warmth to the citizens of the globe. And it is not enough to lift living standards, reduce debt, and create sufficient opportunities for the nearly 200 million people around the world who are officially unemployed and looking for a job. And there is a risk that middle-class families and the poor actually remain behind, which would embolden the voices of protectionism and fragmentation.
Lagarde said the IMF recommends more growth-friendly fiscal policies and an acceleration of the G20 reform commitment by 2016 instead of 2018.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians. This
with all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOANews.com.
Visit VOANews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.
An international edition just happens to be one of those podcasts. Hope you'll check us out there. The next major test in the U.S. presidential race takes place next week with the New York State primary. The two current frontrunners, Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Hillary Clinton, are leading in the pre-vote polling and hope to regain some momentum that they've recently lost. National correspondent Jim Malone has more from the VOA News Center.
Donald Trump expects a home state victory on Tuesday, but Trump has fired off a new round of salvos at the Republican establishment, unhappy that rival Ted Cruz is scooping up uncommitted delegates in other states.
Millions of votes ahead, which they don't even talk about. They never even mention it. They talk about delegates. And I'm hundreds of delegates ahead, but the system, folks, is rigged. It's a rigged, disgusting, dirty system. It's a dirty system.
Cruz says Trump is whining and is trying to bully the party and intimidate delegates.
Nominating Donald Trump would be a train wreck. That if Donald Trump is the nominee, Hillary Clinton wins, and she wins by double digits.
Cruz is running well behind Trump in New York, as is Ohio Governor John Kasich, who has cast himself as an optimistic alternative.
Some who feed off of the fears and the anger that is felt by some of us and exploit it feed their own insatiable desires for fame or attention. That could drive America down into a ditch and not make us great again.
Frontrunner Hillary Clinton is favored in the Democratic race in New York over rival Bernie Sanders. Clinton holds a double-digit lead in most polls and looks to deal Sanders a big setback in New York.
I have noticed that under the bright spotlight and scrutiny here in New York, Senator Sanders has had trouble answering questions. He's had trouble answering questions about his core issue, namely dealing with the banks.
But Sanders continues to draw big crowds like this one in Manhattan and hopes to close the gap on Tuesday.
We have won 7 out of the last 8 caucuses and primaries. And when I look at an unbelievable crowd like this, I believe we're going to win here in New York next Tuesday.
The Democratic race has intensified in New York, said analyst Tom DeFrank on VOA's Issues in the News.
It's getting nastier and nastier, not just on the Republican side, but on the Democratic side, where you've got the two contenders, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, accusing each other of being unqualified to be president, which is just ludicrous on its face.
Both Democrats have New York roots. Sanders was raised in Brooklyn, while Clinton represented New York in the Senate. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
And Sanders and Clinton took part in a contentious debate late Thursday on CNN. Now, International Edition social media correspondent G. Abby Lee joins us with news on whether that debate got much online attention. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve. Hashtag DemDebate is still trending at this hour, and the debate just wrapped up a couple hours ago. Ahead of the debate, the mainstream media reported the two sides traded jabs, but at least on social media, that wasn't the case.
Gee, what did the two contenders talk about on Twitter?
The Clinton campaign focused on attacking GOP frontrunner Donald Trump. She tweeted, You don't make America great again by getting rid of everything that made America great. Sanders, for his part, focused on attacking the Wall Street. Both sides also emphasized their connection to New York. Clinton served twice as New York senator, and Sanders was born and raised in that state. He tweeted, "It's me, Bernie, Brooklyn-born Sanders. And guess what, Ted Cruz? I have New York values."
Yeah, I see. You know, today is also the anniversary of the death of a former U.S. president. Isn't that right?
That's right. It's still Thursday night here in the States, and it's the 151st anniversary of the assassination of former President Abraham Lincoln. He was shot on April 14, 1865, during a play at Ford's Theater in Washington. Steve?
And many thanks to you, G. That is International Edition's G. Abby Lee. You know, you can follow G on Twitter, at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well, at VOA Norman, and you can follow International Edition on Twitter, at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
In central London, Savile Row is lined with stores with custom-made tailoring for men. It'll also be known for Catherine Sargent, the first woman master tailor to open her own tailoring shop on the historic street.
I feel quite proud of my achievement, but it's, you know, been 20 years that I've been training and working in the row.
A craft on Savile Row, primarily dominated by men for 200 years, has evolved to lure more women into the profession.
Last year, all the newly qualified tailors that, you know, received their apprenticeships and their diplomas in Savile Row, 65% of those were women.
Sargent's inspiration in tailoring came from her well-dressed father. In fact, her mother was a knitter. Sargent came up through the ranks working for Jeeves and Hawkes and became the first woman to become the top tailor there before finally opening her own shop on Savile Row in her own name in 2009. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Soul singer Erykah Badu is known as an example of feminism and female strength and recently got into a Twitter war when she commented on an article about a school in New Zealand that mandated longer skirt lengths for female students to avoid distracting male teachers and male students. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about the controversy and its repercussions.
Erykah Badu is a symbol for creativity, a symbol for empowerment, for freedom of expression. This is the woman who, in the video for her song Window Seat, walked through downtown Dallas naked. So for her to come, you know, later on, years later, and say, if I had a school, I would mandate this, was really shocking and very upsetting to a lot of people. And for 48 hours, this Twitter rant between Erykah and people who agreed with her and people who disagreed with her went on and on and on. And I thought it was a very interesting conversation when it was good-natured, because it brought out a number of issues that we don't often talk about, or at least don't talk about enough. And the first one, and she brought this up through her series of tweets, is about nature. It is, in her opinion, in a man's nature to be attracted to a woman or a girl who is of childbearing age. And so as a mother, and she has two girls and a teenage boy, so as a mother, she believed that it's her responsibility. It is her responsibility to teach them that they should dress a bit modestly just to prevent anything from happening. And then there's that conversation, the nature versus principle. You know, should young men and older men be more principled and say, well, even if I'm attracted, that doesn't give me a right to do anything. And then, again, how we socialize, girls versus boys. And this is very, this is a very important topic, especially when it comes to hip hop and certain forms of music. And although she is a neo soul artist, she is also very much ingrained in hip hop culture. And so, you know, hip hop is this hyper masculine culture that will teach young men that to be a man, you must, how can I put this gently? you must romance as many women.
Be in a relationship with a lot of young women, particularly young women in tight clothes.
Yeah, exactly.
Did I get that okay?
Yes, I think that was a good way to put it.
That's the diplomatic way to put it.
Yeah, yeah. And then also the conversation about how attire determines treatment and whether or not your attire should determine your treatment. And this, again, is a very important conversation for many of her fans because she is popular in the African-American community. And years ago, there was a question about whether or not a hoodie, when Trayvon Martin was killed, whether or not, you know, young black men should be concerned about the kinds of clothes that they wear for fear that they may be mistaken for criminals or thugs or whatever. So this is such an interesting and multi-level conversation in which so many layers are being peeled back. And I would recommend if anyone has some time on Twitter, it'll take you a while to follow it.
And if you want to join into this discussion, her handle, Erica's handle on Twitter is at FatBellyBella. That's B-E-L-L-A. And our handle here is at VOA underscore IE. If you want to talk about it with Shauna, she is at VOA underscore music. She's also at VOA Lady DJ. You can log on to our website, also voanews.com.
And many thanks to you, Dave. That's David Byrd, my colleague, and Shauna Renee. Ah, you got to catch up with Shauna on the radio. She's fantastic. Another story for you. Italian researchers say they have discovered living relatives right now of Leonardo da Vinci. Historians who began their work, 40-plus years ago, have tracked down 35 indirect descendants of the man who created the Mona Lisa portrait. Among those is the Academy Award nominee, Italian director Franco Zeffirelli. How about that? Amazing, amazing, amazing. There you go. Da Vinci himself didn't have any children, but he had a lot of siblings. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On March 20th, the Republic of Congo held presidential elections considered flawed. Marred by widespread irregularities, a media blackout during the polls, an imbalanced and restrictive media environment, significant disparity in access to state resources, a short time frame for electoral preparations, and restrictions on freedoms of expression, communication, and association in the pre-election period. In this political environment, President Denis Sassou Nguesso won a third five-year term in office in an election that officially gave him 60% of the vote. Nguesso, who is 72 years old, decided to run for a third presidential term in fall of 2015. Under the country's constitution, Mr. Nguesso was not eligible to run for a third term and was also disqualified due to his age. In order to remove these obstacles, his government proposed changes to the country's constitution that would enable him to run for a third term. On October 25th of last year, the Congolese government held a deeply flawed referendum to alter the country's constitution, despite massive protests on October 20th and 21st that turned bloody when security forces opened fire into the crowd of protesters, media outlets reporting dozens killed or injured. The ruling party announced that the referendum passed with nearly 93% of the vote. Tensions rose as the opposition disputed the results of the referendum. But another protest planned by the opposition for October 30th was canceled since the ban on protests had not been lifted and opposition leaders feared more bloodletting among their supporters. A similar fate befell a press conference planned for March 25th, during which the opposition planned to announce the results of its parallel vote count. The event was disrupted and then canceled when police used tear gas to disperse the crowd of opposition supporters and arrested many of them. Weeks after the government announced President Sassou's victory in the presidential election, violence has escalated in the capital. Heavy shooting and clashes between security forces and the opposition have led hundreds of residents of southern Brazzaville to flee their homes on foot toward the calmer north of the city. The United States is profoundly disappointed by the flawed presidential electoral process in the Republic of Congo, said State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner in a written statement. The United States calls upon the Congolese government to correct these numerous deficiencies before scheduling legislative elections in order to bring credibility to future electoral processes. We continue to urge the Congolese government to respect the people's constitutional rights of freedom of expression, movement, and association. We further encourage all parties to engage in constructive, inclusive dialogue.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.